The link between U.S. policy, corruption, and immigration.
As a result, what happens is that countries like Honduras have struggled to get back on their feet because of the corruption and the poverty that comes with, frankly, gangs able to act with impunity. But then ultimately what happens is that a family makes a perfectly rational decision to say, you know what? My children will not be safe in Honduras. Where can I go? I can go to the U.S.
That's Ali Noorani. We talk with him about his book, Crossing Borders, The Reconciliation of a Nation of Immigrants. Then we talk with Andy Bowman about how solar power is becoming the cheapest source of energy. His book is The West Texas Power Plant That Saved the World. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Millions of Ukrainian refugees are fleeing war. They're being welcomed by the same countries that turn back refugees from other nations, like Syria, that have experienced the same kind of catastrophic destruction from war that's happening now in Ukraine. Ali Noorani is the head of the National Immigration Forum. He says the European and U.S. immigration systems are broken, largely abandoning the humanitarian considerations for refugees put in place after World War II. His book, Crossing Borders, goes beyond the hateful polemics of our current immigration debate to put a human face on the complexities of migration. And he also talks about efforts to welcome those desperate for a fresh start. Ali Noorani is also author of There Goes the Neighborhood, How Communities Overcome Prejudice and Meet the Challenge of American Immigration. Ali Noorani, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to chat. I really am grateful for this opportunity. Thank you.
So your book, Crossing Borders, is extremely salient right now. Well, I guess it always is because the 21st century seems to be even more than the 20th, the century of migration. But the subtitle is interesting, The Reconciliation of a Nation of Immigrants. First off, just tell us what you mean by that.
Well, it feels like coming out of the Trump administration, much less the trajectory of the immigration debate over, you know, the last 10, 15 years, there's a lot of talk about, you know, how do we reconcile our differences at a national level? The case that I make through the book is that the reconciliation of our nation of immigrants begins at the local level in towns and communities and churches across the United States. And I think only then does Congress follow through at a national level. And yeah, I really found a lot of inspiration and hope as I've gotten to know communities across the country and how they are really working hard to reconcile their differences when it comes to immigration.
You know, I think this should be obvious, but it bears repeating. You say that people really don't want to leave their countries, but they're forced to. Of course, we're seeing this now in Ukraine because of the all-out assault of the Russian army on that country. But we also, of course, see that in Central America. And you say that it's actually U.S. policies that are at root of the gang violence in those countries that is at least partly, if not responsible for the majority, at least for a very large amount of the migration from those countries. Talk about those U.S. policies.
Sure. This began really in the 1990s when it was under the Clinton administration federally and then in California more specifically, where you started to see the three strikes, you're out laws being passed. And really the beginning of the mass incarceration of, by and large, communities of color. And what happened in Los Angeles in particular is that as this effort to incarcerate, by and large, again, young males of color, what happened is that jails in California became breeding grounds for the emergence of MS-13. And what you saw over time is that the jails, and just through the sheer density of people and the conditions that people were put into, and frankly, the lack of opportunity for them to find a new opportunity, a new pathway forward, is that, you know, they were arrested for some sort of infraction. They were put into a jail. Then once they were released and had been kind of inculcated into a gang culture, they were then deported back to a place like Honduras. And there's a very clear link between the implementation of those mass incarceration policies in the United States in the 1990s to the rise of MS-13 in Central America, and really the skyrocketing of the homicide rates across Central America, much less in Honduras. And as a result, what happens is that countries like Honduras have struggled to get back on their feet because of the corruption and the poverty that comes with, frankly, gangs able to act with impunity. But then ultimately what happens is that a family makes a perfectly rational decision to say, you know what, my children will not be safe in Honduras. Where can I go? I can go to the U.S. And they are doing anything they can to try to get to the United States. So it's a brutal cycle that we have, quite frankly, played a very large role in creating in terms of the push factors of families leaving Honduras.
And I'm just curious, why do people seek to migrate to the U.S. rather than, say, to other Latin American countries?
Well, the United States has, you know, it's the world's largest economy. There are jobs here, but just as importantly, there are existing family networks here for many, many, many communities. So what happens is that, you know, that family in Tegucigalpa, they know a cousin or an uncle or an aunt, you know, in Tennessee, and they call and say, you know what, I can get you a job roofing or landscaping. So that family back in Tegucigalpa says, okay, not only can I find work in a place like the U.S., but there's also a community or family network to plug into as well. And that's a function or a result of years and years and generations of migration back and forth between the U.S. and Latin America.
You mentioned the word corruption. I mean, it seems that in many ways, corruption is a central feature of so many governments in the world today, and it's really impairing our ability to deal with the incredible crises that we face of many kinds. Talk about corruption in countries where people have to leave. What's the connection between corruption and emigration?
Well, corruption is really the foundation of a society that is struggling to meet the needs of their population, or government struggling to meet the needs of their population. So in a place like Honduras, you have presidential administrations that have been rife with corruption, which then lead to the Honduran National Police being rife with corruption. And once that type of element is planted, then everything that surrounds that system, you know, the ability to live safely in a community, access to an economy that is thriving and growing, all those things become more and more and more difficult. So therefore, because of that corruption at the top, the entirety of the government, in essence, is diseased and is unable to provide any sort of quality of life for communities. And what you see, what I found in places like Honduras and what we see in other countries, is that those who have just enough means to scratch together that $10,000 to pay a smuggler says, okay, get me out of Honduras and get me to the United States. But people don't want to leave. And I think that's one really important part of this, is that if their government was able to provide a stable and safe quality of life, they would never have to make this decision. And that's what was probably one of the most interesting parts about this project, is to begin to understand the collection of factors that drive people to leave a country, but ultimately at the end of the day, they don't want to have to make that decision.
Now, you mention Trump a lot, which I think is natural.
Yeah, it's kind of unavoidable, I guess. Yeah. It got kind of depressing after a while. I was like, oh man, do I have to keep writing about this guy?
Yeah, I hear you. You know, but Obama was actually called the deporter in chief before Trump. And families were separated under Obama and are still being separated under Biden, maybe not with the same flagrant degree of impunity that happened under Trump, but it's still happening. So I wonder if you could talk about the systemic reasons why the U.S. immigration policy is so cruel.
Well, this is really traces back to, you know, quite frankly, most recently the attacks of 9/11, but then even over the course of history, you know, we have a long and tortured relationship with immigration over, you know, really since, you know, the early 1900s. And there have been just multiple steps really since 1924 to create an immigration system that is frankly designed with the goal of keeping people out as opposed to welcoming people in. And as a result, whether it's the 1924 Immigration National Act or the 1952, between 1924 and 1965, we saw a hardening of the immigration system. In 1965, it, you know, opened up quite dramatically because of the things that President Johnson and bipartisan groups of members of Congress did at the time. But really since, you know, 9/11, we've just seen the hardening of our borders so that systematically our process is designed, like I said, to keep people out. And, you know, I think we're starting to pay the piper on that approach, as not only are we facing a labor shortage, not only are we really struggling to figure out, okay, what's the long-term competitiveness of the United States, but frankly, our refugee and our immigration systems are unable to meet the moment of the crisis that we see today in Ukraine, what we saw last summer in Afghanistan, or we're seeing every single day around the world.
Yeah, and talk about Ukraine now, both as an example of migration writ large, and also as a difference to the kind of immigration debates that are so rife in this country and so polarized.
Well, it's been a really interesting, and that's not the right word, it's been a dramatic and all for all the wrong reasons immigration debate since the Biden administration came into power. You know, because you remember, you know, last summer, if we were having this conversation last August, we would be talking about the evacuation of tens of thousands of Afghan allies. And what we saw as a result, it wasn't necessarily the federal government stepping up and saying, we're going to do the right thing here. It was veterans who served in Afghanistan, their family members, their friends, conservative, moderate, liberal, who are saying, you know what? These are folks who served alongside our troops. We've got to get them to safety. And that continues to this day, whether it's the ongoing attempts to evacuate people or resettle Afghans across the country. And we're seeing something similar with regards to the war that Russia has inflicted upon Ukraine in terms of a broad public support. But the problem is that those two examples, one, let's be honest, is a Muslim community. The other is, what, by and large, a white European Christian community. Like you're saying, the outpouring of support for those communities is not what we see reflected in the ways that we talk about or serve those who are asking for protection at the U.S.-Mexico border or those coming from Haiti, for example, to southern Florida.
You mentioned 9/11, but you also, in this book, and Ali Noorani, in Crossing Borders, you also talk about the war in Syria as an inflection point in what you call the weaponization of the immigrant crisis. So could you tell us what you mean by that? How did Syria change things so seriously?
You know, going back, and as I was taking a deeper dive into the Syrian war and kind of what it came from, and there's so many lessons to learn, and it's almost worth a book unto its own, but I'll do it quickly, right? So the Syrian war breaks out, and what we see are these pictures and these stories of millions of Syrians fleeing this awful war. And first you see the boats trying to get across the Mediterranean into southern Europe. Then you see, as that route starts to close down or really be seen as dangerous as it is, you see families, as I put it, kind of slogging through the mud of the Balkans and trying to get into Eastern Europe through, you know, Turkey and then into Hungary and then from Hungary into the rest of the EU. What happened in Hungary is that Viktor Orban, who was the prime minister then and remains a prime minister, he said, you know, he wrote in early September of 2015, just after Prime Minister Angela Merkel said Germany would welcome Syrian refugees, Orban said, well, Syrian refugees, to paraphrase, they are not Christian. And what he did is he weaponized the Syrian refugee crisis to bolster his own political fortune, to really shift the politics of immigration, not just in Hungary, but across the EU and eventually across the world. And it was very much like you said, it was an inflection point in terms of the politics of immigration, it led to the externalization of borders, both by the European Union and the United States, as a very, very clear strategy, and has really, as we're seeing now, it gutted the United States refugee resettlement programs and immigration system, because Donald Trump said, you know what, I kind of like what Viktor Orban is doing. I'm going to emulate that.
Explain what externalization of borders means. And was this a violation, in fact, of international law by EU countries?
So in 2016, so in 2015, the Syrian refugee crisis occurs, or really in the fall, Orban's rhetoric is initially dismissed or debated by European Union leaders. And they say, you know, he does not represent who we are as the EU. By the end of the year, there was some softening by European Union leaders, where they just realized that, okay, Orban, he may be onto something. And what they did in 2016 then, first of all, is to set up an agreement in March of 2016 with Turkey. And what it means to externalize the borders is that the external border of the European Union is Hungary. What they then did is say, okay, let's pay Turkey, which is not an EU member, to stop migrants who are trying to get from Syria or Afghanistan into Europe. So stop them at the Turkish border. Let's pay Turkey to handle that process, to, you know, have the resources necessary to enforce their borders differently. And then let's, you know, accelerate their process to enter the EU. So Turkey very much was the external border of the European Union without being the European Union. Then the EU did the same thing with Libya, where they set up an agreement between Italy and Libya, so that Libya's navy, if you will, was tasked with stopping boats as they were trying to get from Tripoli to Italy. And just recently, there was an amazing investigative piece in The New Yorker that found that these detention camps that have been set up in Tripoli are some of the most deadly camps in the world for migrants. And then in the U.S., under the Trump administration, he tried to externalize our U.S.-Mexico border to Mexico's southern border, much less Central America, by, you know, holding foreign aid to Central American countries, in essence, hostage to whether or not they would harden their borders.
And we have still under Biden the return to Mexico policy. Isn't that correct? That started under Trump?
That is correct. So one of the things that Trump did was told migrants that if they're going to apply for asylum in the U.S., they had to remain in Mexico. And, you know, the Biden administration, to their credit, they attempted to dismantle the program. A court forced their hand and required them to re-implement the program. But, you know, I really think that the Biden administration needs to be much more clear and forceful in terms of moving forward to end the migrant protection protocols once and for all, but then also ending the Title 42 public health restrictions. And let me be clear here, Francesca, I'm not advocating for open borders. And that's why I said the book title is Crossing Borders, because I understand the need for borders to for a variety of reasons. But I firmly believe our borders need to be much more humane in the treatment of people.
So dive down a little bit more deeply into that. First of all, why do we need borders? And what does it mean to have humanitarian borders?
I think we need borders because, quite frankly, that is the way that the world operates that we live in this in this day and age. And I think that to have a conversation of whether or not we need borders, I think skips over the more important problem right in front of us, is how do we make sure that our borders are meeting the challenge of migration today? Or I should say the opportunity of migration today. So at our U.S.-Mexico border, for example, I think it means that the administration is ensuring that there are the immigration judges, there are the lawyers in place so that if somebody is applying for asylum, they have access to a fair and equitable process to pursue their claim. That we have a functioning legal immigration system so that that family in Honduras is not paying $10,000 to a coyote to take an incredibly dangerous and often deadly trip to the U.S.-Mexico border. Rather, they are able to apply and pay for a work visa or a family visa to enter the U.S. So, you know, there's always this tension of being compassionate, but then ultimately being able to exert control over our borders as well. And right now, I would argue we neither have a compassionate approach nor a controlled approach.
We don't have a controlled approach because you're saying people are driven to illegality because it's so restricted.
We are not controlling the border. The cartels are controlling the border because we, in essence, have outsourced our migration system so that it is the cartel who is determining who can or cannot leave Honduras, who can or cannot cross the border to apply for asylum. So that is, let's not pretend we are controlling that system. We have outsourced that to cartels and smuggler networks, and they are the only ones winning in this situation.
Now, a very interesting take of this book is when you turn your lens onto what creates the attitudes towards immigration in this country. And it seems that, you're motivated by a certain degree of compassion and understanding for those who, are so nationalistic or are so opposed to any kind of immigration. So talk about the fear and mistrust that you see that underlies this, and where the social roots of that fear and mistrust are.
Sure. So the National Immigration Forum, the organization that I run, has for years always approached the immigration debate in a way where we're really trying to bring people into the debate, new people into the debate, which means that as an organization, we are sitting down with folks and really trying to understand, okay, what are they scared of? And then what will help them better understand the values of immigrants and immigration? In 2018, we organized a couple of dozen what we called living room conversations across conservative communities in the U.S. And we sat down with pastors, police chiefs, business owners across the country. And what we learned through these conversations that we did in partnership with an organization called More in Common is that there were three fears that would come up over and over again in the conversations: culture or race, security, and the economy. So from a cultural perspective, the question would always be, are immigrants, are they integrating or are they isolating? In essence, are they becoming Americans or are they living within their own communities? From a security perspective, the question was, are immigrants and refugees, are they threats or protectors? And then from an economic perspective, the question or the fear was, are immigrants, are they givers or takers? Are they taking jobs and services or are they giving back to the country? So we have found that if we understand those three fears, that will come up in slightly different ways, but those are the three core fears for so many Americans, then we can have a conversation that addresses those fears. And what we found is that, and what I saw through the research in this book, is that having the right conversation with the right people and the right leadership creates these spaces so that people can say, you know what? I understand why I'm scared. I understand why I don't need to be scared of immigrants. And I want to think about this differently.
And that actually worked because we're so polarized.
Well, I'll tell you, in the book, I tell you this, I write about Twin Falls, Idaho. And this actually links to the Syrian refugee crisis, because in 2015, when Viktor Orban and Donald Trump are weaponizing the Syrian refugee crisis, this little city of Twin Falls, about 50,000 people in southern Idaho, conservative Idaho, they become the epicenter of the immigration debate around the Syrian refugee crisis. Hundreds of people show up at local hearings about whether or not Twin Falls should resettle Syrian refugees. A mosque is vandalized. All these terrible things are happening. And what happens is that conservative leaders within Twin Falls realized that they had a responsibility to help the public see this differently. So you had the Idaho Dairymen, the LDS Church, the Catholic Church, evangelical churches, police chiefs, the mayor, city councilors, all in Twin Falls, not just working on their own to make the case for immigrants and refugees in Twin Falls, but they worked shoulder to shoulder with the Latino community, the refugee community. So yes, it does work because, at the end of the day, in a place like Idaho, it is not going to be me, a Washington, D.C.-based immigration advocate, who's going to change the narrative around refugee resettlement in southern Idaho. It is going to be the community of southern Idaho and, by and large, the culturally and politically conservative community in southern Idaho that is going to change that narrative.
And why did they want to change that narrative? What moved them to create that opening?
It was a combination of their personal story their values and their living. So for many dairymen, for example, in southern Idaho, their families left the Netherlands in just after World War II. So they had in their recent family history the experience of fleeing war, of being pushed off of their land, of kind of scraping together a life and a family and a business from practically nothing. I mean, this was, you know, the current generation of dairymen, this was their parents, their grandparents at most. So that memory is very clear to them. So when they saw in 2007 how the Bush administration was targeting, you know, Latino farm workers in Idaho, the dairymen gathered as an association and said, this is wrong. This is what happened to my parents. So there's this very, very kind of personal connection. Then many of them are, you know, people of faith, and they realize that, you know, their faith was telling them they have to do a better job of welcoming the stranger. And then as dairymen, you know, they, you got to milk a cow twice a day, 365 days a year. But as a result, these dairymen, they're working, you know, shoulder to shoulder with, you know, a Mexican immigrant, a Honduran immigrant. So they hear their stories. So it's, you know, it's much more than kind of an employer-employee relationship. They see them as part of their family, and they see the journey of the immigrant today similar to the journey that their immigrant parents or grandparents took.
That's a great story.
See, it works. See, I told you.
Well, there's so much more, actually, also in your book, Ali Noorani and Crossing Borders, The Reconciliation of a Nation of Immigrants. It was a very clearly laid out and interesting read. Yeah, it has lots of great stories in it. It does seem like it's getting harder and harder to have those kinds of conversations. And I'm really hoping going forward, I mean, do you see that there are openings or ways that we can create that common ground to open up the debate on immigration?
You know, I think what we're realizing, whether it's on immigration or any of a number of other issues that we all care about, is that we have to learn how to talk to each other about these issues in a different way. You know, whether it's democracy or poverty or, you know, climate change or immigration. And, you know, our kind of informal motto at the National Immigration Forum is to meet people where they are, but not leave them there. And I just really hope that, you know, whether it's through reading this book or having, you know, our own experiences of kind of being able to sit down and kind of really hear somebody that we may not agree with, that we begin to not just think of these issues differently, but we begin to think of each other differently. Because I think each one of us has a responsibility to do the work to get out of our respective silos.
I totally agree with that. Well, Ali Noorani, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about your book, Crossing Borders.
Thank you so much, Francesca.
Ali Noorani. Go to writersvoice.net to find out more about his work and the National Immigration Forum. Next up, green energy is the cheapest energy. Stay tuned after the break. Here Comes the Sun by the Beatles. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Andy Bowman has been in the renewable energy industry for more than 25 years. In that time, he's seen solar power go from being a highly expensive niche energy source to cheaper than fossil fuels. His book, The West Texas Power Plant That Saved the World, tells the story of the moment that solar started to beat out dirty energy in the energy market and what that means for our future, if we can deploy renewables in time to save the planet. Andy Bowman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
You focus in this book, The West Texas Power Plant That Saved the World. This is called the Barilla Solar Project. Tell us about that project and why you think its significance is so huge. I mean, it actually is no longer in existence and went out of business. So give us that story.
Yeah, the Barilla Project is a very small project out in West Texas. It's just west of the town of Fort Stockton. It actually is still operating, although, as I tell in the book, it had some pretty serious problems for for a couple of years. But this is a very small project. It's 14 megawatts, and it was built in 2014. And in many ways, it would be a project that's really not notable. It's small. It's one of many projects out there. And it's very similar, you know, in almost every way to other solar projects that have been built, you know, before it and after it. What's really unique about it, though, is that it was built on spec. It was built without a contract in place with a buyer before it was constructed. And that may not sound like anything really notable, but the thing about power plants is they're very expensive to build, but they make money very slowly. They have to sell their power over, you know, 10 or 20 years to, you know, provide a good return for an investor. And so that fact has resulted in the reality that if you build a power plant, you really have to have that buyer lined up for all of its output for 10 or 20 years time before you finance it and then construct it. There have been a few different types of technologies that have produced power at such a competitive price that they have not needed to have those contracts in place. In the electricity business, those are called merchant power plants. And the idea is it's kind of like a merchant that just shows up at market every day and sells its goods at whatever the going price is. The only way you can build a merchant power plant is if the technology that's generating the electricity is so competitive, is producing at such a low price in comparison to the going rate at the time, that you'll be assured that you can make your return just selling it at whatever the prevailing price is. So the only projects that had ever been built merchant up until the Barilla plant was built were natural gas and coal power plants. And so what's really notable about the Barilla project is that it was the first solar merchant power plant. And the argument I put forward in the book is that this is the first time that solar is demonstrated to be the dominant competitive power price generation out there. And so I make the case that solar, as of, you know, 2014 or so, is in the same place that fossil power plants were when they were built as merchant, which is to say it's the new cheapest way to deliver power into the electricity business. And as I note in the book, you know, since that power plant was built, even though it had some financial troubles, and we've seen a bunch of merchant solar plants built since then, both in the United States and other countries around the world. And it seems to be something that's growing because this is a very competitive way to produce electricity.
Yes, you know, I live in a community in East Hampton, New York. Our local utility several years ago put out an RFP for energy, any kind of energy. And they chose a wind project, not because it was clean energy, because at that time they didn't really care about that, but because it was the cheapest at the time. Now, it was still pretty expensive, and we have some of the highest electric rates in the country here on Long Island. So talk about wind power, which is, you know, really going full blast here offshore the East Coast, versus solar, because we were told at the time, there were some people around here who said, well, why not build solar? But solar was not seen as a competitor at that time. So could you talk about wind and solar and how they're shaping up now?
Yeah, it's a great question, because there's a lot of similarities between them. Really, the story of both of them is that they were, you know, new technologies at one time, and they were very expensive. And they've both become much, much cheaper and are, you know, forecast to become cheaper yet as time goes by. Wind really started in the 70s and 80s and really got going in earnest as a way to generate power in wholesale markets, really got going in the late 1990s and then 2000s in very windy places like California, Texas, Iowa. You know, much of the middle of the country, a lot of places in the Northeast as well. Wind is a great way to generate really cheap electricity. Solar has come on, and the story I tell in the book is that, you know, in the early 2000s, solar was so expensive And many of us continue to think about solar as being a really expensive way to generate power. It was at that time. And what happened was that the solar manufacturing really was reinvented through a series of events starting in the 2000s and ending up in the early 2010s. Solar went from being one of the most expensive ways to generate power to one of the cheapest. And increasingly, it is beating wind in many parts of the country. It doesn't sound like that's what happened in the process you described with your local utility there, but often it's a horse race in any particular situation, whether wind will be cheaper or solar will be cheaper. But more and more often, solar is the best deal out there. And one reason is that solar generates, you know, definitionally all day. And that's when we use the most electricity. So there's greater demand for what solar provides, whereas wind, depending on which part of the country you're in, can often provide a lot of its annual output during nighttime hours. We use energy at night, but we tend to use a lot more during the day. And so when you factor in the time of day value of energy, often solar comes out on top. But, you know, as the story you recount with your local utility, you know, shows, either way you go, it's looking like clean energy is the cheapest there is. And as we look at what's happening offshore in the northeastern U.S. and it's starting to happen offshore of California with floating wind turbines, we're seeing the beginning of a whole new kind of energy, which is offshore wind. It's extremely windy off the coast of the eastern seaboard of the U.S. and off the coast of California. And I think we're going to see a lot of projects built. And the wind speeds, the patterns of wind offshore are much more consistent. And so they would produce a good, you know, round-the-clock power. And the U.S. industry is coming off the bootstraps, really, of the European work in offshore wind that has really figured out how to do it and figured out how to build these projects offshore and how to do it cheaper and cheaper. And so we're the beneficiary of all that experience. And in Europe, some of the cheapest power you can buy today actually comes from offshore wind projects. And we're even seeing some offshore wind projects get built in Europe with no subsidies in a very merchant-like setting, which is very exciting.
One of the issues here in terms of solar was that Long Island is a densely populated place in spite of having a fair amount of farmland, and there just isn't enough space for solar. And that brings up the question of utility solar, the utility solar model, and the distributive solar model. Distributive meaning, you know, the solar panels that people put on their roofs. Could you talk about these two models? Because you really focus mostly on utility solar in this book, The West Texas Power Plant That Saved the World, Andy Bowman. But a lot of people feel like distributive is the way to go. So talk about those two. How do they work together? Are they in competition?
Yep, it's complicated because of the way that our electricity markets work. But I think I can lay that out, and it's a very interesting question, you know, because they're two totally different worlds, really, in the way that we get our electricity. The utility scale solar projects are typically built over hundreds or thousands of acres of land, depending on, you know, what part of the country you're in. And in a densely populated area like Long Island, it can be hard to find enough available land, you know, for a large project. There are a lot of efficiencies that you get when you build a large utility scale project. There are just some economies of scale that allow you to generate cheaply. And those economies of scale benefit on the construction side, on the procurement side, and the financing of the project. And so the cheapest solar you can get is going to be utility scale that sells into the grid, which is to say it sells into the wholesale power market. The other way is with a distributed approach. And when you put solar panels on your roof or in your yard, the power that you're generating is competing with the retail energy price. which is going to be much higher than the wholesale price. And it really goes down to the details of the way that your local power company has decided to work with distributed generation solar and the particulars of the way that your solar project on your roof is installed. For instance, some utilities are very solar friendly and they will basically buy the output of the solar panels on your roof and then use the proceeds that they're paying you to offset your power bill. And so that can be a very favorable approach for homeowners putting solar. It can really accelerate the payback period. And I have friends in Austin where we have a very friendly utility in this regard who installed solar panels several years ago. And, you know, their power bills are, you know, $5 a month, more or less. But every local utility in every state has different laws and approaches and programs. And some utilities really don't like to see distributed solar because it's basically competing with the power that they sell. And so it can have a profound effect on their revenues. And there are some important issues there. A lot of local power companies have a commitment to provide electricity to customers in densely populated areas, as well as customers in remote areas. And it can be expensive to maintain all the power lines out to a remote area, for instance. And so when you start doing things that have a significant impact on maybe reducing the amount of power that they're selling to customers because so many people are installing solar, it can make it difficult for them to do the things that they're obligated to do, like providing power out to those remote areas. So there are a lot of complicated issues that could affect the way that any particular, you know, local utility arranges their program. And unfortunately, this can have a huge effect on whether, you know, installing panels on your roof makes sense or not. It really needs to be a local decision that you make. The solar companies have gotten really good. They'll provide a lot of this analysis. They'll do all this homework for you when they present a proposal. But, you know, generally speaking, distributed generation solar is displacing power that you would have bought from your local utility. And it's often doing it at a really cheap rate relative to the high prices that you might be paying in your area and can be a really wonderful deal. And it's all serving to displace fossil fuel generated power that all serves the same goal, which is reducing emissions from those kinds of power plants.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Andy Bowman about his book, The West Texas Power Plant That Saved the World. He's an expert in solar energy and renewable energy storage. You know, right now, California, the Public Service Commission in California is proposing a huge tax on distributed solar that people, the solar industry is also saying will really put the kibosh, will slow down the adoption of solar. And, you know, other people counter that, yes, solar may cost utilities, but it also means that utilities don't have to build new generating power because when they lack enough power supply, they can get it from the rooftop solar. But I have another concern about utilities, and I know this is not in the book, but I really want to ask you this, and that is with so much moving to electrification of buildings, electrification of transportation, the burden on the energy grid is going to be great in a time of increasing disruptions from extreme weather events. You know, when the grid goes down, I'm hooked into the grid, I have solar panels on my roof, I don't have storage because it's still too expensive for me to put in. You know, I lose just as much power as anybody else, even though I could be generating my own electricity. So could you talk about this whole issue? How are we going to have a resilient renewable energy grid in the face of climate disasters?
Yes, I totally agree with you with the premise of the question. You know, we are consuming more and more power in almost, you know, every way. I think Americans don't do a good job at energy efficiency. And when you look at all of the new things we're coming up with to do and to make money with, there are so many things that require even more electricity, and a lot of them are not totally intuitive. For instance, almost everything that you do with your phone, you assume it's a small phone. It doesn't consume a lot of electricity. You charge it for a few hours and it lasts all day, that it have a very small carbon footprint. But in fact, the things that we do with our phones now, or our computers for that matter, you know, is buying things on websites, looking at photos, sharing social media, you know, just all of the increasing digital aspect of America's, you know, daily life, and indeed, you know, people around the globe. All of those things access data centers that store all of this data and that process it and make it all available to us 24/7, 365 within a few taps. And data centers are the quickest growing source of new electricity demand that we've seen in this country in the last several years. And they don't seem to be slowing down. And so to your point, you know, we're consuming a huge amount of electricity. The grid, on the other hand, moves very slowly. There's a complicated process that grid operators use for considering decisions about building new transmission lines that typically takes several years to get approved and then several years to get developed and then constructed. And then all of that's happening in the face of, as you described, much more extreme weather. Here in Texas, we had a terrible storm last year about this time that put the entire state just about in below freezing temperatures for 5 days straight. And you probably saw news about that we just had failures across the board in our power system. Natural gas wells weren't able to deliver. They froze. Natural gas plants had water pipes freezing that shut them down. Wind plants had so much ice on the blades that they weren't operating for some periods of time. You know, even solar plants were covered in snow for a small period of time. Wind and solar came out the best in that because they got back to work pretty quickly. But it doesn't matter whether it's an unexpected, you know, polar vortex arriving in a part of the country unprepared for it, or a terrible tropical storm, or a drought, or a heat wave can make fossil power plants inoperable if temperatures get too high or they don't have access to water. There are just all kinds of ways that our grid is exposed to some serious vulnerabilities with different extreme weather that we're certain to see more of, you know, as the years go by. I think the challenge of resiliency is a really serious one that grids are focusing on. And I think you make a good point, too, that many people assume that if they install solar panels on their roofs, then they're going to be able to generate all day, at least in a time when the grid is out. But it typically doesn't work that way because you are delivering the power from the panels into the grid and still taking your service from the grid. In order to have availability of service from the panels directly, you need a differently wired system. And a lot of grids don't prefer that homeowners integrate solar panels in that way. And so without a battery system, which has its own limitations and as you say, is pretty expensive now, you know, you don't get that security of being able to ride out the loss of grid in the way that most people think that you would with panels. So we've got a lot of work to do is the bottom line. I do think that, as we saw in Texas, renewables are much more resilient in a lot of these weather challenges that we're going to see. But they're not perfect, and they can't supply all the power we need whenever we need it. And so there's been a lot of work going on in different grids around the country looking at these extreme events and how to be prepared. But it will require a lot of investment, a lot of new power lines and new ways of building power lines, burying them, for instance, instead of putting them overhead in areas prone to forest fires, that kinds of thing. But we've got a long way to go, and it's going to take a lot of money and time to get the resilient grid that we're going to need to deal with the weather patterns that we know are coming.
Andy Bowman, in the West Texas power plant that saved the world, one of your theses is that capitalism, which actually has brought us to this pass of an energy system that is destroying our planet, can also get us out of the mess. And, you know, we've already spoken about how you do that by having, you know, this power plants built that can compete on the open market. But as you point out in the book, there really isn't an open market. There is huge subsidies that dwarf the subsidies for renewables, huge subsidies for fossil fuels. And we don't yet have a price on carbon. You know, you say we're going to need a price on carbon. But, you know, here in New York State, where we have the groundbreaking New York Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, has not been funded. And when last year we tried to get some legislation passed for an act that would actually fund it by putting a price on carbon, it got destroyed in the press. The fossil fuel industry went all out calling it a gas tax. Carbon prices, carbon taxes are not popular. How are we going to put a price on carbon to get capitalism to work for a renewable future?
Yeah, I think it's one of the most important questions there is about how we're going to respond to climate change. When you look at the concept of the carbon budget and the idea that we only have a certain amount of greenhouse gases left to put into the atmosphere before we guarantee that we will exceed 2 degrees Celsius of warming, which is the gradient that scientists agree we're certain to experience very dramatic, very negative changes to human civilization if we exceed 2 degrees Celsius. When you look at just the math around when we would have put enough of those emissions into the air to guarantee that, we're talking about 15 years plus or minus. And this is the headline that you see in the news sometimes about people saying, you know, there's only 12 years left to address climate change or something along those lines. If we don't find a way to really quickly reduce emissions, then we're going to bust through 2 degrees Celsius. And there's a huge body of scientific work around the idea that we really want to remain below that band. You know, the argument that I make is that it's no coincidence that capitalism began in the early 1700s, which was the same time that we saw the first coal machines built, the first machines that utilized coal burning it to do work. And so we have seen these two technologies, these two ideas grow up together, and they're very much entwined. And, you know, it has been the basic tenets of the way that we've run our capitalism, you know, from the United States to Europe and, you know, just about everywhere around the globe, with just a few exceptions. That's the economic system. And it's powered all day, every day, all year, every year by electricity and combustion engines that are causing climate change. 80% of greenhouse gas emissions can be traced to burning fossil fuels, whether in a power plant or in an engine powering a vehicle from point A to point B. So we have got to change the rules of our capitalism to make things that don't produce emissions more appealing, cheaper in the market, and things that do produce emissions more expensive. And that will get capitalism moving in the right direction instead of digging the hole we're in deeper, you know, starting to fill it back up. There are huge questions about how to do that, and in particular about the equity issues around that. All of us depend on electricity and energy for everything we do, from the time we wake up in the morning, making our coffee that's been transported, you know, halfway around the world from Brazil or somewhere else, to using our phones, as I was talking about earlier, driving to work or taking the bus to work, being in our offices or our schools, or, you know, everywhere with air that's heated or cooled all day long, every day, all the food that we eat. has an enormous carbon footprint, whether it's the fertilizers for the transportation, the heating and cooling, et cetera. So we've got to fix our capitalism to start helping instead of hurting. But we've got to do it in ways that recognize that we all depend on electricity and energy for our quality of life and for making a living. And so what that means, there are a variety of ways that people have thought about how to do this. And the biggest one is to introduce a carbon tax and at the same time introduce a carbon dividend, which is to say that you take a lot of the money that was raised by taxing carbon and you pay that out in a dividend to people that is used to subsidize their costs going forward. And there is so much to transition from the world that we're in today with all of the fossil fuel emissions powering, you know, so much all day. But we've got to get it moving. And it's very encouraging that wind and solar have now reached a point where they're cheaper, even in spite of all the subsidies that thermal power gets. Wind and solar receive subsidies, but if you look at it as objectively as you can, and I spend some time really trying to peel away the politics and just look at the numbers in subsidization, the amount of subsidies that are available for oil and gas have been just staggering. And so this idea of a carbon dividend, I think, is one of the best ideas out there for putting more money in people's pockets so that they can pay the costs as we make this transition to ultimately cheaper and cleaner costs. And ultimately, moving to cleaner energy is going to, in time, reduce the extreme weather events, which are also extremely expensive. Any of the storms and the droughts and the wildfires that are occurring cost a huge amount of money. And so those are expensive, you know, costs that need to be tallied into the figures as well.
Yes, although we had the tax and dividend idea here with the legislation that went down, it seems that people don't really understand the dividend idea, and that's been an issue. But I want to ask you about storage. You know, it is too expensive right now for most people. You're in that storage space. What's on the horizon? Will it get to the point where people can, in fact, afford to have home batteries?
Yeah, it's a very exciting space to be in. You know, you can have all the wind and solar that you want, but the fact is, you know, at night we like electricity and there's no solar at night. Some days are windy and some days aren't windy. And so we're really going to hit a ceiling with our renewables if we don't find a way to, you know, cost efficiently store a lot of that energy. And then there are other issues, which is that there are power line constraints getting from remote, windy and sunny areas all the way into the cities. And energy storage can help moderate the constraints on transmission lines by storing it up in the windy or the sunny area until there's some open space on the transmission lines to move the power across. So there's just enormous potential for getting storage built, and it needs to happen for renewables to become, an even bigger part of our climate solution. One of the things that is most exciting about storage is that when you look back and you see how wind started as a very expensive technology and then went through a series of changes to become as cheap as it is today, that pattern was reproduced even quicker with solar. Solar was very expensive and in a much shorter time became, you know, super cheap as it is today. What we're seeing with storage is a very similar pattern occurring at an even more accelerated rate. And storage is too expensive today. It's a lot more expensive than we like it to be. I think we're early in the storage business, but we have line of sight to some really dramatic price drops coming down the road. When you look at the manufacturers of battery storage, for instance, lithium ion, some of the biggest companies are in China. And those companies are doubling and tripling and quadrupling the size of their manufacturing capability. We're also seeing many of those companies begin to build factories here in the US, which is a very exciting development. And just yesterday, we saw LG, one of the large Korean companies that's very active in storage, commit to becoming even larger than some of the large Chinese manufacturers. And so all of these things are going to dramatically increase the supply of energy storage inputs, and that's going to lower the price. And if you look at long-term price forecasts over the next few years, they're going to come down very quickly. You know, there's some commodities issues that the supply chain is bringing to storage like every other business this year. But, you know, looking out over the next few years, it's going to get much cheaper. I think it will become an affordable option for homeowners in the next 2 or 3 years. And I think that would be a really great option for people to have batteries, especially with solar panels on their roofs, because that'll just be a bigger and bigger part of the day that they're supplying, you know, most or all of their household needs.
Do you foresee a way that the two systems, you know, the utility solar and the home energy storage, will be able to actually work together instead of as competitors to hasten our transformation to a decarbonized economy?
Yeah, it's the same dynamic in both areas, the wholesale utility scale and the, you know, home distributed generation side. You've got very cheap ways to generate electricity with solar panels, and they're infiltrating in our markets, in our capitalist markets. They're infiltrating both in both areas. The real challenge and the divergence that you're asking about there is with often the local power company, because when people put solar panels on their homes, some of those local power companies see them losing a customer. In my book, I talk about something called the utility death spiral, which is a very dramatic term, but it refers to this dynamic that as renewables get cheaper and more competitive and more people sign on to them, utilities that are committed to generating their power with, you know, old fossil fuel plants that they, you know, sell the power to ratepayers under protected schemes. More and more customers are going to be choosing the cheaper and the cleaner power. And that's going to leave those companies in a really precarious position financially. And these are some of the biggest power companies in the country. So what needs to happen is I think they need to be good capitalists. You know, how about this? Buy the cheap, clean power that's available and work with your customers and your ratepayers to give them what they want, which is more access to cheap and clean power at their homes. Design their long-term plans and their financial plans to see more decommissionings of the coal and gas plants. And start working towards this change instead of resisting it and creating what's potentially, you know, a big fiscal problem for them, you know, as the markets evolve over the coming years. That's really the direction that I'd like to see it move in. And I think just for their own financial self-interest, there's a lot to recommend them moving in that direction as well.
So you're saying that if they move more aggressively into the renewable energy space, they're giving renewables to their customers, and those customers who are distributed, I guess I'm not sure, how can microgrids, distributive energy, and utility grids work together, or can they?
You know, I think it comes down to the utility's view of what their business is. If their business is serving their customers and their customers want to have distributed generation at their homes, then they need to meet the customer's needs, which is, you know, providing grid power as backup power when the distributed panels on roofs aren't meeting the need. If they don't view their business that way, if they view their business as selling power from traditional fossil power plants under protected, regulated rate systems, then they're going to make life difficult for people that want to put panels on their homes, and they're going to arrange those programs and lobby regulators and fight friendly solar schemes to protect the revenue that they depend on. A lot of this comes down to, unfortunately, policy, politics, and regulations at the state and local level. And we're seeing those fights, like you mentioned, the latest change in California. California has been very friendly to rooftop solar. You know, there are some really hard issues, as I mentioned, with these utilities that we expect to provide power to everyone, everywhere, at all times. There are costs associated with that. And so I think one needs to really look at all the facts, but sometimes it's not, it's trying to protect a monopoly style business model in a world that's changing and becoming much greener and much more deregulated, that's allowing customers to choose cheap, clean power. And I think that's a losing battle for them. And they need to, you know, if you can't beat them, join them and start trying to figure out how to support customers that want these choices.
They could buy cheap electricity from them and distribute it through the grid to people who can't put solar on their roof.
That's right. Exactly.
Well, it's a great book to read, The West Texas Power Plant to Save the World, Energy Capitalism and Climate Change. Andy Bowman, it's been a delight to talk with you about this very important subject.
Wonderful. I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much for having me.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.